Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor.
Today I'll be talking to Baroness Stroud, the new head of the Legatum Institute. On the surface, Philippa Stroud has the perfect Westminster CV, yet her story is actually one of the most fascinating and unusual in modern politics.
If you look at your CV for the last 10 years, and just look at the CV, it looks like a very sort of Westminster thing. You founded a think tank, the Centre for Social Justice. You were Ian Duncan Smith's special advisor. You went to the Lords as Baroness Stroud of Fulham, which is about as metropolitan as it gets. And then you went back to the CSJ, and now you're running Legatum. But then, if you look at the sort of sweep of your career, you spent 20 years doing all sorts of things which no one else in Westminster would really have done.
I think that's probably right. So I started my career, if you can call it that, in Hong Kong working with drug addicts. And I was living and working in a slum area of Hong Kong called the Wall City, which has in fact been pulled down now. It was an area of Hong Kong that had been left out of the treaty between Britain and China and was therefore a no man's land.
Because just no one was that bothered about it?
Well, no, because it was in fact Chinese territory but inside British territory, so it couldn't be policed by anybody. And what it meant was that it became a haven for Blue Film Theatre, drug addiction, triad activity. And I had the privilege of living there and working with the people who lived there before it was pulled down. And we worked with drug addicts to see one life changed one at a time. And it was just an amazing privilege to see the courage of these individuals as they went through the decisions that they needed to make to change the trajectory of their lives.
And did you have any family connections with Hong Kong, or was it just sort of spin the wheel and see where it lands?
No, I had thought I was going to go into international banking post university, and I had done work experience in the city in a merchant bank and in a French bank, and had very much thought that that would be, you know, I'd do the standard, go to university, leave university, go and work in the city. But I just, as I was ending my time at university, and I had spent, I'd studied French, so I'd spent a year in France, and during that year, I'd had more time on my hands than probably you would normally have, because I was in a foreign country, I didn't know that many people, and I got to observe French society, and I was in this beautiful city, Aix-en-Provence, but actually the thing that struck me about it was the homeless people, and I didn't have any answers, and I tried talking with them, I tried giving them money, I tried buying them loaves of bread while they were asleep and leaving them there, and none of it was satisfying. And it led me to ask questions about how do you really care for people who are seriously disadvantaged. It was one of those just extraordinary set of experiences. When I was in France and I came back to the UK a couple of times for holidays and things, I had a number of people just come up to me and said, "Oh, you really remind me of this lady who's leading this work. Have you ever thought of going to work with her?" And I hadn't, but it just kind of got me to start thinking. And then numbers of different people started. Told me about the work that she was doing, and in the end I thought, you know what, just on the off chance I'll write to her. And I wrote this letter to her saying, I'm not experienced at working with people with addictions. In fact, I'm a French student. but if you would be interested in having me, I would be interested in coming. And we spent a year of kind of corresponding backwards and forwards. But in fact, before she even said yes, I'd bought my ticket to go to Hong Kong because I was so convinced by that stage that I should be going.
And what was it about what she was doing that spoke to you?
I think it was that she had an understanding of how to work with very disadvantaged people and see life transformation and see lives completely turned around. And I didn't know of anywhere else where they were really doing that. And I think that what was so extraordinary is that if you are an addict in the UK and you go through a drug rehab centre and you fall out of it, or you don't succeed going through it, the chances are you may get one other chance, but you won't get many opportunities. But what she was doing was saying, if this takes, you know, 12 times, 15 times, 18 times, or whatever, we are committed to seeing you go on your journey through this. And you often find that with addiction, is that people don't make it the first time. And but actually each time they come back in, they make another choice and they go a little bit further. And it was just amazing to see her commitment to the whole journey of an individual, not just that moment that they were in her program.
And presumably you weren't sort of commuting in from the nicer parts of Hong Kong.
I spent how long? Probably about 8-10 months living in the walled city, and then I went out to Macau and led a drug withdrawal house out in Macau of addicts who were coming off heroin, and actually lived in the program itself.
Did you ever feel sort of in danger? Because I mean, you presumably didn't speak the language. You were sort of thousands of miles away from home. I mean, and these are people who are in a really, really bad situation.
Yeah, no. So I did I ever feel in danger? I absolutely loved being there, but it wasn't without its danger. I mean, like the really annoying thing is if you got a taxi back to the whole city, they sometimes wouldn't take you there, which was actually even more dangerous because they actually didn't believe that that's where you were going. So they just didn't want to be the person who
was responsible for dropping off the poor innocent white girl. Who
yeah,
was in.
So that was really annoying. I think I got to know quite a lot of the guys in the walled city, and therefore they were quite protective of us actually as well. But it wasn't without its danger, obviously. But it was an environment that I loved being in.
And then you decide to come back to the UK to sort of set up a similar program.
Yes.
Over here, is it?
Yes.
In Bedford, is that right?
So I set up a four-stage project in Bedford, which was a night shelter, a hostel, a rehab house and a halfway house back into the community. And that was taking some of the principles, but obviously working in a UK context is there's a lot more legislation, a lot more things that you need to be aware of. But that was a real privilege as well. That took me 10 years to build that project.
Is it still going today?
Yes, it is. So not in exactly the same format, but the work itself is going there. And I always said to the people there when I left, which is many, many years ago, is the houses are just a vehicle. It's the work and the vision of the work that's crucial.
But you mentioned before that, you know, you were sort of disappointed that no one else was doing this kind of work. Were you quite driven by the data in an odd way? I mean, were you sort of looking at how successful you were compared to other approaches?
Do you know, I think I have become, over the last 30 years, highly data-driven. In my early 20s, I was not experienced or data driven. We were focused on seeing life change one by one. Now that I have seen things from a government perspective and from a community, not just a personal transformation, but a community and national transformation perspective, I'm a lot more data driven.
At what point do you sort of decide that you need to go into politics effectively, that you need to, you know, that you're sort of saving souls on an individual basis is all very well, but that national policies need to change? Is it just a sort of chance encounter with IDS? Or is it...
No, it was before a chance encounter with IDS, actually. In fact, the chance encounter with IDS came because I was looking for a way to take up onto a national level the things that I'd been learning on a local level. So after Bedford, we went to Birmingham and started supported accommodation for homeless people. And I think the Bedford project took me 10 years to build, and what we were doing in Birmingham took 5 years to build. And I think that in the middle of all of that, I had my children. I had three children, and it was a good pause moment for me to kind of reflect back on the last X number of years and think, actually, it has taken this amount of energy and this amount of hard work and dedication to build projects that see life change one by one of about 50 people. But then down the road, there's another 50, and down the road, there's another 50. And bearing in mind, we were living in Birmingham, so the landscape was much bigger than somewhere like Bedford. And then down the road, there's another 50. And yet the causal factors of all of this are exactly the same. And I just started thinking, you know, I could keep building these projects, or I can start turning off the tap and seeing whether or not we can start doing some national interventions that actually reduce social breakdown.
What was different about your understanding of the problem than other people's?
So the people that I was working with on the projects that I was working with were not short of money, but nowhere could they go to get the sort of interventions that they needed. So I remember one day I was actually coming down to speak at the Conservative Party. I wasn't a Conservative Party member at this point in time. I was coming down to speak at the Conservative Party, and I just thought, and I was coming down to speak about the role of the voluntary sector in the community. And I just thought, I believe I know what's driving all of this, but I had jolly well better check before I come down and take a platform. I thought I would just sit down with each of my residents one by one and in private, so that they weren't kind of bouncing off each other. And I asked each of them the question, if there could have been something that didn't happen in your life that would have meant you wouldn't have needed a place like this, what would it have been? And literally, to a man or a woman, they answered the question, it all began when my father walked out or my stepfather walked in. And the disintegration of the family and the violence in some of these families and the abuse in some of these families was such a theme running through what we were doing, but that was not being talked about in a national politics.
It was kind of treating the symptoms, not the cause.
Yeah, so it was like governments were very happy to pay lots of money, or not lots of money, but money to these people. But actually, what they really wanted was strong, stable families.
And I suppose this is why you end up with the Tories rather than Labour, because most people who've been working in the voluntary sector in the churches are, you know, would tend to drift to the left, because that's seen as the kind of compassionate part of society or politics.
Yeah, so I think that, I really seriously looked at each of the different political parties, because I was not political at this point in time. But I felt that only redistribution through the welfare state was not going to be the answer to the nature of the problems that I was seeing on the ground, and that although the thinking was not that well developed at this point in time within the Conservative Party, the innovative thinking and the thinking that was mirroring and reflecting what I was seeing on the ground was coming out of the Conservative Party. So I had just met Tim Montgomery, and he at that moment in time had been invited by William Hague, this is going back a long time, into the basement of Conservative Central Office, which was in Smith Square at that point in time. And he had founded an organisation called Renewing One Nation, and they were looking at the life cycle of people and the different interventions at different stages that were required. And that was a lot more along the lines of family, education, mental health, work, indebtedness, these sorts of things, which developed into the five pathways to poverty. This was a piece of analysis that we did for a piece of work actually commissioned by David Cameron, but looking at the pathways to poverty, which were family breakdown, failed education, addiction, debt and welfare dependency, and obviously the five pathways out were the stabilising of families, decent education, mental health solutions, managing one's money and work.
But obviously you become most, you sort of get, not national prominence, but you get sort of problems within the Tory party when you link up with IDS, who's had his own road to Damascus moment at Easter House when he goes up to see the worst sink estate in Glasgow and is just appalled by what he finds.
Yeah, so it was a really extraordinary meeting of Ian and I, because I was just asking the questions, how do I translate everything I've learned from a local level up onto a national level. At the time where we met, just after he had lost the leadership. So he was asking the question, I had this platform, I no longer have this platform, how do I use who I am on a national level to take forward everything that I've just seen on a local level? And we meet, and Tim at that point in time was just finishing being his political advisor, and the CSJ is born out of that.
It's hard to sort of recognise now because these are all sort of quite well entrenched ideas, but primarily there's universal credits, but also things like modern slavery. You know, the sort of social conscience of the Tory Party starts to really grow during that time.
Yeah, I mean, it was huge, exciting. I mean, we look back now, and these themes are very familiar now within the Conservative Party. I mean, it went from the Breakdown Breakthrough Britain reports, then we took universal credit into government, Theresa May did the Modern Day Slavery, which had come out of the CSJ, as you say. Then we built the Life Chances agenda in government, which was a mirroring of the five pathways to poverty. But actually, when we started out, all these themes were pretty much not in existence. And I can remember Tim, when we first launched the CSJ, he did a picture of a typewriter which only had three keys to it, which were Europe, immigration and tax, and that actually the vision of the CSJ was to restore all the other, it was an old-fashioned typewriter, all the other keys to it, of family, employment, you know, managing our personal finances, all of these sorts of things, modern day slavery. And so it became a hugely exciting agenda to be part
and,
of.
And presumably the fact that Cameron is trying to do much the same thing.
Yes. No, very, very, very exciting. And the hugger hoodie that he was known for was actually at a day conference that the CSJ hosted to bring together all the players in the early intervention space. And we actually entitled the conference Thugs Beyond Redemption? I mean, it sounds awful now. And actually, we had it was looking at gang culture. Is there a possible way out? I mean, that's what we were. These were the questions that we were asking, and lots of the work that the CSJ did was on gangs and looking at creating pathways out for gang members.
On the modern slavery issue, actually, Theresa May has just given an interview confirming that it's something she's proudest of. And we actually talked to Frank Field for another of these interviews, and he said it was a conference you hosted that that sort of started the ball rolling. And his claim was that Fraser Nelson had sort of gone over time and left Frank with about sort of 20 seconds to say something. And Frank hadn't really prepared anything because he'd not really wanted to go to the conference. He'd been told by his advisor that he needed to do something to look like less of an immigration. He'd been talking about immigration and he needed to remind people that he cared about the poor
fascist.
As well. Yeah, fascist is the word he used. And so then he said, well, I've only got time to say two things. Let's call it slavery and we need a bill. And then from that, the avalanche starts. That's a sort of snowball that starts the avalanche.
I mean, that the story of the modern slavery bill is extraordinary. I don't know whether you want me to tell it here.
No, please. We can always.
You can always edit it. I can remember the day that a few young businessmen came to me at the CSJ. This is a number of years ago, and their question to me was, how do you go about changing something in a nation? And they asked me that question before they told me what they were interested in. So I said to them that the best way of changing something in a nation before you even embark on the journey is you have to understand that issue really well from top to bottom. You have to know all the evidence of it. You have to have done a complete analysis of the nature of the problem, and you have to have developed solutions that match the scale of the problem if you really want to go about changing something. And often in politics you have kind of solutions that sound like they come somewhere near the problem, but actually they don't genuinely resolve the issue. And I said, if you really want to resolve something, you have to have a clear analysis of the problem with scalable solutions that match the size of the problem. And so they just said to me at the end, right, we want one of those. And the issue that they wanted it on was modern-day slavery. So I said, well, one of those report costs us this amount to do. And they said, right, we'll come back to you when we have the money. And they went and raised the money for it, and they came back and they commissioned the report. And they were absolutely amazing. And then I can remember once the report was published, everybody thought that it was completely self-evident that you would do it. And because there was such a packed government kind of legislative program, it got stuck in number 10. And I can remember, conversations with advisors in number 10 where I was told, Philip, this isn't a priority. And I wrote an email saying why I thought it was a priority for government and why...
And you were in government by this point.
Yes, and why I thought that British families didn't want our progress as a nation made on the backs of slavery. And I remember Oliver Letwin emailing me and saying, I think we need to talk about this, Philippa. You obviously feel quite strongly about it. And they said, if you can find a Secretary of State who will take the legislation through, you can do it. And I thought, should we go to William Hague? He'd written the William Wilberforce book. Or should I go to Theresa May, who is Home Secretary? So this is obviously in her perch. I thought, I knew Fiona Cunningham and Al Hill, and I thought, I'll have a chat with Fiona. And she was just like, we need to be in this space, Philippa, and Theresa will definitely want to do this. And we met, and it was just like an open door, so it was amazing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah. What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
To put it politely, not everything in government goes as smoothly. And in particular, you and IDS get in with this agenda for universal credit, which requires spending extra money and sort of massive institutional and organisational changes, especially to database systems. And neither of these quite happen at the scale or pace with which you'd want them. And there is a running battle with the Treasury for 5 years. I mean, is that...
That's about accurate.
Are you sort of proud of what you accomplished, or are you regretful about what didn't happen?
I am proud of what we accomplished. And in fact, universal credit is being rolled out and is obviously a huge change to the welfare state, and will restore work incentives to those in employment. That's already happening. Would I have liked to have done it not in an age of austerity, when we could just have had a clear run at positive welfare reform?
Because the idea was that work should always pay, and that turns into not working should always be punished in some respects. There's a slider between stick and carrot does shift because Osborne needs to.
I wouldn't agree with that. Work after universal credit will pay. We would have liked the system to have been more generous. I've been quite vocal about the fact that I think that the last lot of cuts that were taken out should be reversed.
These are the ones that IDS resigned over?
No, actually, the ones that he resigned over never went ahead. These were actually, when the tax credit cuts were reversed, the cuts to universal credit, which equated to the cuts to tax credits, were not reversed. So although people will be transitionally protected as they move from one system to the other, so they won't feel any loss, the investment into universal credit, if you were a new claimant, is less than it would have been. And the other thing that I think should be removed is the 7-day waiting period as well. So those are two things that I would love to see addressed in universal credit. The actual system itself, a universal credit is just a mechanism through which you put money in from the welfare state, and that structure itself and that method of delivery I'm really proud of. But the thing about being in government is that there are lots of competing agendas. And obviously, we took forward huge welfare reform at a time of austerity, and that was a real challenge.
And what about the organisational issues? Because there's also the fact that there were these two giant databases for tax and for welfare that needed to be crunched together, and the project is reset. And as well as the battles with the Treasury, you have battles with the Cabinet Office under Francis Maude. I mean, did you bite off more than you can chew?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that we ever thought this was a small task to do. What was really interesting is that, and I think this is not what is understood by what happened. I'm not sure it's a story that's really been told. But we went into government in 2010 and took the legislation through in 2011, and the department pretty much started the build of universal credit straight away. At that time, the only way of building a huge welfare system was through a traditional legacy build.
So you mean signing a giant contract with the giant IT company?
Yeah.
Of exactly the kind that Francis Maude then tries to get rid of.
Absolutely. So then in 2012, the government publishes its digital strategy. Bearing in mind that we had already started building universal credit by this time. In 2013, what follows is basically a philosophical battle about how you build big systems. Do you build a legacy build, or do you build an innovative digital build? And that's basically the battle that kind of rages. And in 2014, we basically decided to build both. So the traditional legacy system is what begins to get rolled out, but during that time we're building the digital system, which will be the long-term system, and that enables us to bring people onto universal credit safely and well, and begin to see some of the transformation and test it and get the change that's required in all of the Job Centre Pluses all the way around, and the systemic change, which actually then enables the introduction of the digital system to happen significantly more smoothly. I mean, some people argue that it's a model way of doing it. It didn't feel that way.
I mean, did the experience sort of sour you on government as the thing to be inside?
No, it didn't. It's interesting. I definitely came to the conclusion that if you look at the five pathways to poverty, family, education, addiction, debt and welfare is the one that you have to be in government to change. All of the others you can actually change and find levers for outside of government. So I'm really grateful that we had those years inside government in order to really address that one. But I was looking forward to also being able to address some of the other ones from outside government.
When you were in government, did you ever feel the need to repeatedly say, I've done this, I've been at the ground, to prove yourself? Or was it an easy transition? I mean, lots of people feel that politicians are incredibly disconnected, and obviously you've worked on the ground not only in the UK but also in Hong Kong. So did you ever need to say, I've actually done this, I actually have a leg to stand on?
Assert your moral authority?
Not particularly. I hope that my approach to all of these issues in government always demonstrated an understanding of the people that we were working in order to benefit. So one of the things that I always tried to do when I was in government was create an open door for people who were working on the front line to connect in with us, and to give them an opportunity to influence what we were doing. So as a special advisor in government, I was probably had significantly more meetings with external charities, voluntary sector organisations, etc. Partly I wanted to remain connected to what was happening on the ground. But in my mind, all the time, I had the faces of people who I had worked with over many years, and often I was thinking, would it have benefited so-and-so? Would it have benefited so-and-so? If not, let's not do this. And if it would, then let's really put some energy behind this.
But I mean, you have the advantage, I suppose, that most people in your position, special advisors, are in their 20s, their job is to protect their minister politically and to hopefully, you know, get them, make their way up the ladder. You and IDS are both quite clear, to the frustration of George Osborne, among others, that, you know, you are in government to do this thing.
Yeah.
And you have this mission, and that's what you care about.
Yeah. And I think, and also neither of us were motivated by building a career. And it meant that the weighing up for us all the time was, can we do more in government to benefit the people that we started this journey for? And the moment that balance became balanced the other way for us both was a time not to stay, because you always have to. There will always be a moment to go. I think most moments of going are not particularly glorious in government. And I think for us it was always, we know what we're here to do, it's government is a way of doing it, but it's not the only way of doing it. And if there is a way outside of government that is more effective, then that would be the route that you would choose.
So were you already sort of on the exit path when the offer of a place in the Lords came through? I mean, was this kind of a cunning way of getting you out of the way, or was it? How did that come about?
I had, in fact, after the 2015 election, I had spent quite a bit of time during the Perda period of the election thinking, what do I want to do next? And when Ian came back as Secretary of State into the Department for Work and Pensions...
Yeah, because you're not expecting to win the election, or there's a significant doubt about
that. Yes, so everyone has their plan A and their plan B at that moment in time. And I kind of fell in love with my plan B. And but when Ian went back in, I knew that he was going to need to take 12 billion out of welfare. And I hadn't thought that I would go back in with him, but when he went back in, and it was quite obvious that that task was going to need to happen, I thought, that's a really, really difficult task. Do I want to leave it to somebody who doesn't know the welfare budget inside out, and who will do it brutally, or do I want it to be done as carefully as possible?
Well, I mean, how do you make those decisions?
And well, so that's why I went back in. But when I went back in, I said to Ian, "I'm only coming back in to help you do this. Once this is done, which I thought would be about Christmas time, I will leave." But that was purely between Ian and I. And then, but then, in fact, Cameron asked me to go into the Lords.
I mean, that must have been sort of quite agonising. I mean, you've already made all these cuts. You personally believe that they're not justified. You know that people will suffer if you do this. So how do you make those decisions about who suffers most?
I mean, they were hugely difficult decisions to make, and they were ones that, you know, behind the scenes, I expended a huge amount of energy explaining to people the consequences of doing them, and in fact, a good proportion of them never happened.
But where were you trying to shift them to and from? If you see what I mean,
I actually didn't think it was possible to take that amount out only from working age. So there are huge parts of the welfare budget that, through promises that were made at the election.
The triple lock, for example.
Well, the triple lock, but also on the universal benefit. So as the election went on, more and more was being taken off the table. More and more promises were being made. So what was difficult but possible when Osborne first announced it became almost impossible by the time we actually came to the table, because so many areas of the welfare budget had been taken off the table, and which is why when I came out of government, I spoke and wrote publicly about the fact that the tax credit cuts should not go ahead,
and presumably also that the triple lock should. I haven't actually looked up what your position is on that, but I assume that it's all very well, but it's protecting pensioners at the expense of others.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the triple lock and protecting the pensioners is that I'm not sure that the triple lock is necessary, but I think that the thinking behind protecting pensioners is right, in that these are people who are least able to change the trajectory of their life just because of the life stage that they are at. But there's a whole kind of swathe of universal benefits that I always thought, why are we protecting universal benefits of people going right up the income stream when we're removing welfare?
TV licences, bus passes.
Yes. And I genuinely believe that there should be a very honest conversation and almost a commission on welfare, cross-party commission, because Labour are known to protect, you know, the benefits of the poorest, and the and rightly so, and Conservatives are known for protecting the universal benefits. But actually, we should be asking, what is a 21st century welfare state required to do, and what is the best way of constructing it? And it shouldn't be providing an income for people who have a decent income.
And so when you go to the Lords, is that because you're needed in the Lords, or because Cameron wants to get you you out of the way, or just a sort of, as a reward for work well done?
I couldn't comment, but I do know that there was hardly, when I arrived in the Lords, was hardly any welfare experience in the Lords and on the Conservative benches. And it's been a real pleasure to be able to speak on issues of poverty, welfare, family, homelessness from the Conservative benches in the Lords.
And so you, as well as going to the Lords, you then go back to the CSJ, and then you make this leap to look at Tullagartum, which is where we are today in this beautifully appointed library. And you know, so you're going from this area you know an awful lot about to suddenly a sort of very different focus. So for those who don't know, Tullagartum's sort of flagship project has been the Prosperity Index, which is a measure of how prosperous and open and secure and happy and functioning countries around the world are. So was it a case of sort of widening your horizons, or being a bit bored with welfare after all these, in the UK after all these years?
No. So when I started having conversations with the Tullagartum Institute about coming here, one, as you rightly say, the flagship programme is the Prosperity Index. But the Prosperity Index is not quite as you've just described it. It's actually about economic and social well-being and what drives and creates healthy and strong societies. And
property rights, rule of law,
yes,
democracy,
yeah,
open markets, you know, all.
Yes. And so for me, this has been about having the space to build the from poverty to prosperity arc, and also to identify the top challenges of our generation and the top opportunities of our generation, and to so Tullagartum actually means legacy. It actually means how do we pass a better legacy onto the next generation? And for me, that is about addressing the challenges and taking hold of the opportunities. Now, some of those challenges are very fairly and squarely in the poverty space. And some of them, which is why we focused on Brexit, for example, are very much in the Brexit space. But even when you look at what's going on in Brexit, you have all the kind of trading opportunities, but you also have the 52% who voted for this, and the reason why they did that was because of job insecurity, lack of access to housing, education challenges, and health challenges. And some of these things are very much the space that I've been in for a very long time.
And you've got in Matthew Elliott, who ran the Leave campaign, who's looking at populism for
you. Absolutely, and then you have to ask the question, what is sitting underneath populism? It is a lot of the, we saw this with the Trump vote, is actually a lot of this is coming out of the more disadvantaged communities. And I just feel that to put the strength of the Institute behind research on these issues, with all my experience of frontline poverty fighting, community transformation, and then national transformation, is actually just an extension of everything I've been doing all the way through my life.
Although you followed this arc from the very personal, which is working with addicts on a one-to-one yeah. basis, to the sort of the vast and impersonal, in the sense of, you know,
yeah.
how what makes countries yeah. work, and what make, and also with your work on the work on free trade, you know, what makes relationships between countries work in the way that delivers prosperity.
Yeah, but if you listen to our special trade commissioners who are here, they totally understand that one of the best ways of addressing poverty is actually through trade. And I think that...
I was at the back of the room, actually.
Yeah, well, you've heard Nicholas Nigley talk about this. So for me, if I take my own journey, I saw lives change one by one, then communities transformed, and then was involved in transforming a national transformation program. So for me, this is all coming out of life change on a one-on-one basis, because actually you don't get national transformation without it. It's made up of one life after one life after one life.
So the thing we haven't talked about, which is sort of one of the through lines of your career and sort of the why you're doing this, is religious faith. And you know, you've obviously... There's been some controversy in your career over, so the Bedford Project, for example. There are accusations that people are you know, gays and transgender people are, you know, are having the demons prayed out of them, and you know, that you are, that, and your husband is a church leader of the kind of, who signs up to the Westminster Declaration, which is a very sort of conservative version of Christianity. I mean, does that coverage reflect your views?
No, not at all. And in fact, I was. It's heartbreaking, actually, for me, that was, because it doesn't represent my views. And I have the privilege of working with people from hugely diverse backgrounds, and that for me is a very rich experience. And I was deeply saddened.
Would you say you'd been on a personal journey, or just that you were, in that kind of horribly cliched way, or just that you were, you know, that you were misrepresented by the press?
So for me, I think it would be true to say that I have spent all my life trying, in a very non-judgmental way, to support people to fulfil who they are and their potential, and as being as inclusive as possible. So I was in fact at the department involved in helping the gay marriage legislation go through. So for me, it's, as I say, it was heartbreaking.
It's when you Google your name, that's one of the things that comes up. And likewise, when you Google the Bedford Project, it comes up as, this is a group of crazy evangelicals who are doing crazy things, which presumably might put off people from coming to be helped there.
I think that for the people who know them and who work with them and who go to that project, it's been really beneficial for them. I mean, the great thing about a voluntary sector organisation is that people can choose whether or not to go there or not. And when I was there, we had homeless people, addicts, alcoholics. This is who we were working with, and so the way that it was represented was not how it was.
I mean, one of the things Frank Field said was that there's this weird paradox where the church as an institution, or you know, faith as a, is collapsing within society. It's sort of ebbing away, but yet so much of the good work within society on a grassroots level is being done by people of faith. So his example was the fact that, you know, the Corbynite activists in his constituency seem to devote most of their time to trying to get him deselected. And if they spent, you know, a fraction of that time helping out at food banks, say, yeah, the world would be a slightly better place.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we are, you know, we talk about being a tolerant society, and yet we're often actually quite intolerant of one another. And I think that we can grow in our respect. And I had the most beautiful conversation the other day with a Muslim friend of mine in the House of Lords. And I was just trying to understand her faith, and she was trying to understand mine. And at the end of it, we actually said to each other, you know, if this had been recorded as a BBC kind of listening project, it would have been a really rich experience, as she was telling me about the fact that the Muslim faith, their idea of loving their neighbour is to serve seven houses to the left and seven houses to the right. And I thought that was really, really beautiful. But we need to understand each other's faiths better, so that actually we can have them. Faith is running through the heart of society. It does. If we push it to the sides, actually that's when you get extremism. You actually need faith running through the warp and weft of society, because that's when it's healthy.
And I mean, were you brought up in a religious household, or did you have that conversion experience?
No, I wasn't brought up in a religious family, and my faith just kind of grew quietly, and was deeply personal, and has probably just grown and been an enormous strength to me. I don't speak about it I don't really speak about my faith, but it is the strength that drives me in so much of what I do. And
hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's why I'm deeply committed to individuals of all sorts of backgrounds, because I view a human being, regardless of anything they've done, said, or whatever, as deeply valuable.
Thank you for listening to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor, and I hope I'll see you again next week. If you like this, please subscribe.
Thank you.